Sleep apnea is a common disorder among the general population, but it's even more common among veterans. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Dr. Eric Dykin is a professor of neurology at the University of Iowa and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A person with sleep apnea will have moments during sleep where they actually stop breathing. The action the body takes to start breathing again is disruptive, and the toll apnea can take on a person can be serious. Today, we'll talk about the disorder and why veterans are four times more likely than the rest of the population to suffer from sleep apnea. We'll also talk about the link between obstructive sleep apnea and stroke. And Dr. Dykin will answer your questions about sleep. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 or tweet us at IPR Talks. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sleep apnea is a common disorder among the general population, and it's four times more common among veterans. Today, we'll talk about sleep apnea and other sleep disorders, and we'll also be taking your calls and your questions about sleep. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today is Dr. Eric Dykin. He is a professor of neurology and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Dykin.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I think we should probably start with a refresher course. Sleep apnea is your specialty, one of your specialties, and we've talked about it on the show before, but let's start with a refresher course of what exactly it is for people who don't know.
Essentially, when you go to sleep, all your muscles relax. And in some of us, there's a relaxation of all the muscles, including the muscles in the back of the throat. And in some of us, those muscles relax so much that the tissues get sort of floppy. And that often translates to that famous snoring we have all heard about. But if it becomes excessively floppy, it's almost like sucking in against a wet straw. The walls of the throat come together and you have what we call an apnea. So the airways close down, you don't get in any oxygen to your heart or your brain, and that is a bad thing. And that's sleep apnea in a nutshell.
And over time, what kind of a toll does that take on the body?
Well, you know, it's like, for the most part, it's not the first cigarette that gets you. It builds up problems for the entire body system. And the big problems with sleep apnea is that low oxygen affects the cardiovascular and the cerebrovascular, or the blood vessels to the heart and the brain. And untreated over a 4 to 12 year period, Terry Young and the Wisconsin cohort, some of our buddies in research, they have shown that you're at higher risk of developing high blood pressure, and after high blood pressure follows often heart disease and stroke. So it, when it's untreated, is a risk factor for high blood pressure, heart disease, and stroke.
And what are the risk factors for sleep apnea? Who gets it?
Well, you know, there are a variety of things that can cause sleep apnea. And the stereotype, and that's what you alluded to, is the middle-aged man who's overweight. So we tend to gain weight, men, in an what we call an android or a male fashion, and that's on our belly. This belly adipose or fat tissue tends to parallel a little bit of fat in the throat. Now, in the throat, a little bit can go a long way. And it's like cellophane on a baby's face. You take that cellophane off, put it on the scale, it doesn't weigh a thing. But put it over the child's face, it's 1,000 tons of concrete. Same thing with a little bit of fat in the back of the throat. You put a little bit in that small opening, and it can cause excessive collapsibility and then sleep apnea. And that's the stereotype.
That's the stereotype, but these are not the only people who can suffer from sleep apnea.
I got sleep apnea. And some people think it may be the shape of the throat, maybe a more high-arched throat that has a narrower, as such, you know, very high arch. And there are some kids. My wife's a pediatric sleep expert. She sees a lot of kids with developmental disabilities and some congenital, what we might consider abnormalities. And if you have a very, very small chin, it tends to push back against the throat and makes a small airway. So there's a lot of children with congenital defects, if you will, that may be at higher risk for sleep apnea, and they're just skinny, itty-bitty little things. If you overdose on alcohol, you too will have an apnea while awake or asleep. So medicines, excessively, alcohol, excessively, excessive weight, and certain anatomical predispositions can cause apnea. The number one cause in little children is kissing tonsils. Those things get big. Sometimes they get in the way.
There have been these studies released over the last 6 months. We've seen it in a number of different places that veterans are at a much higher risk for sleep apnea. Why would that be?
Well, you know, that's interesting. To me, you know, I love the VA. It's just great patient population, you know, friendly people. They've been through hell and back, and, you know, so they're always so nice to you and everything. But there tends to be still in the military, and I don't know the exact numbers, but a predominance of middle-aged males. And a lot of people think, and this would be my speculation, just pure speculation, we know that middle-aged overweight males are at a higher risk. And that's because men tend to place their fat in a more belly or abdominal fashion, and that tends to parallel an increase in the fat in the throat. We formally call that lateral pharyngeal fat pads. I think because in general, it's a select population of men that might be the reason.
Okay, so it may be a sort of a confounding variable.
Yep.
That we're seeing this high number of veterans suffering from it, but it may be because we're looking at primarily a middle-aged male population.
Yep, and as you know, in America, God bless America, in the Western society, there's an epidemic for obesity. And I don't think that the veteran is at any less risk than you and me. For being that we can sit, get work done at the computer. We don't have to go out and run around. And then when we get home, we've got Blu-ray. What do you need to move for anymore? And I think – and we're well-fed in general. A lot of our brothers and sisters aren't. But in general, God bless America, there are the negative elements of a successful society that we're learning to deal with. I think – that's my speculation. It's the epiphenomena.
Well, I want to talk about some of the treatments for sleep apnea. And Julia from Marion has a question that you get all the time, I'm sure. And okay. She says, if you lose weight, does that reduce the severity of sleep apnea?
It did for me. You know, and there is some indication that Papard and Terry Young, again, this group from Wisconsin, they've done a lot of work on this. They've seen that you can reduce the number of times per hour you stop breathing. And we lovingly call that the apnea hypopnea index, how many times per hour you might have a closure of your throat. You can reduce that if you reduce your weight. I lost about 55 pounds. Dr. Rahman was my doctor. I don't take care of myself. He followed me. And by doing that, I didn't get rid of my apnea completely. But if I lay on my side or my stomach, I have zero apneas. If I go on my back, my kids see it like when we're at church camp and things. You lay on your back on a church pew, gravity pulls the tongue, the throat together, and I'll have apneas. But in general, with weight loss and laying on my side, and we call that positional therapy. I have some pillows and things and a specific little device that helps me sleep on my side. I don't have any apneas. That helped my insurance. I think that's helped my health. And I don't snore and gasp and wake my wife up anymore. So that's one therapy. Weight loss can help. I have a handful of people out of about 20,000 that I've seen that have lost enough weight that they've got rid of the apnea, but a lot of people who will often need less therapies like the continuous positive airway pressure therapy that we'll talk about probably later, CPAP, sometimes you can get by with less pressure. So there's a lot of different therapies, but weight loss is good for your heart. It's good for your brain. It's your blood vessels, your high blood pressure, your diabetes, your lipids. And as such, it's really good for your apnea.
And you mentioned having a device that keeps you from rolling onto your back. What is that device?
Well, there's a lot of different devices, and we just tended to pick one out. And there's a little strap-on kind of a thing that you sort of snap on around your chest. And it's got a nice little pillow on the back. It's really hard to just lay on completely. You can roll over with it, and it just in general allows you to move back and forth but not lay flat on your back. So there's a variety of these. I guess I shouldn't really name trade names, but they work for me because I will flop around. And if I don't have these pillows or a device, now I'm going to lay flat on my back because it's just so darn comfortable, and then I wake up gasping.
Well, and it also sounds like something that you could do yourself if you needed to.
Now, that's brilliant. What we used to do before the company saw there was a way to make money, and again, it's a nice service and people are willing to buy it. We used to get a tube sock and fill it up with tennis balls and then sew it back to, you know, to the back of a shirt. So you got this long white-coated doctor telling a 55-year-old guy who was still playing rugby who's overweight, now you get your sewing kit, and fill that tennis – and then they go, yeah, doctor. And they go home and the wife says, well, what's the therapy? I don't know. He told me to sew us. And, you know, they don't take you seriously. But when you have something that's pre-made that is actually on the system that you can send away for, it translates, I think, to something that looks a little more valid. Because when you tell somebody, go don't get a tube sock, it just wasn't working too often.
Okay. So it takes on importance if it comes from someone else. You mentioned the continuous positive air pressure, which is, I believe, the most common treatment for sleep apnea, the CPAP machine. How does that work?
Well, what it is, it's a small mass that goes over your nose, sometimes over your nose and your mouth, for people who are mouth breathers, if their nose is broken and they don't have good airflow. And this mask is attached to a machine that delivers a gentle column of air that acts as a stent to keep the airways open, sort of simple, simplistic way of looking at it. And over the years, they've made that much more comfortable. Oh, gosh, it used to be big and loud, and a lot of people still hate it, but a lot of people find it a lot more comfortable. And across the board, if you're my middle-aged, overweight male relative, that's the first thing that I'll recommend to you is the CPAP therapy. It takes you a month to get used to, some people a lot faster. Some people never, but for the most part, we have a pretty good success rate because we got one heck of a technician who you can call 24 hours a day, who will follow you up to make sure that it is comfortable.
And how quickly would you see results, and what would those results be? If you start using a CPAP machine, you're sleeping better, what would you notice?
The reason, and you know, and again, this is a branch of medicine in its relative infancy, because a lot of the ways we have technically to monitor sleep apnea are relatively new. And as such, it's really fascinating to be part of this, you know, tremendous knowledge increase. So every day we're learning something new. But I like to empathize with the patient because I'm a patient myself. And what I had, what got me diagnosed is I was waking up with severe chest pain. And on Thanksgiving. Grandma had come over and I woke up with severe chest pain and I was sure as having a heart attack. So I did what any smart doctor would do. I went to the basement, laid in the fetal position the remainder of the night because I was too embarrassed to call 911. My wife said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I think I'm having a heart attack." And she's smart. She said, "I think it's reflux. I think you have severe sleep apnea. You snore like a banshee. You ought to go see somebody for it." And I said, "Well, I run the laboratory. How can I?" And she says, "You're not the doctor. You are the patient. Get this taken care of." I put that on the first night, and my chest pain was gone the next day. I had some other issues. It was a very uncomfortable mask. It took me a while to get adjusted to it. And that's where I started our CPAP clinic, where the technician makes it comfortable for you. But I noticed it immediately. Most people may take longer than that.
But it made a difference for you right away.
Right away.
We'll talk more about sleep apnea and other sleep disorders in a moment. We'd love to hear your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll start taking your questions right after we get back from a break. My guest today is Dr. Eric Daikin. He's a professor of neurology and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Dr. Eric Daikin. He's a professor of neurology and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We've been talking about sleep apnea. We also will take your questions about other sleep issues in your life. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And first up, we've got Claire on the line from Ames. Hello, Claire.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question about?
I have a couple of questions on behalf of my partner, who has basically gotten 0 to 3 hours of sleep every night since he was born because of a traumatic family situation. He's now 34, and I was wondering if you could comment on the health implications of that, and also if you had any advice for seeking a situation with a sleep disorder clinic, since it would probably take him at least 4 days to fall asleep, and that seems pretty financially limiting.
Well, you know, there is a broad spectrum of normal. So this bell-shaped curve that Grandma always talked about in regard to sleep, that you need about 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Well, that's true for 90-some percent of us. But at the feet of the bell-shaped curve, there are some people who require only 3 hours per night, 3 to 5, something like that. And there are some people who might require over 16 hours of sleep. That's central nervous system hypersomnolence. And, I've seen people who have been told that, you know, you've got to get 8 hours of sleep. They said, my entire life, I've only got 3 hours of sleep. Now, one of the things that happens is when you have a bed partner or family members and you're only sleeping 3 hours, the rest of them can't tolerate it. And I've seen people go into retirement facilities where they'd get a roommate and beg for a sleep medicine so that they could stay sedated while their roommate slept, because the roommate couldn't stand them being up all night. Otherwise, they were very effective and efficient. You imply, though, that there are negative side effects for your significant other. And again, oftentimes, relative sleep deprivation can lead to daytime sleepiness. And the thing that immediately translates to me is you could be dangerous in a variety of situations. And for most of it's what we're doing some research on now with John Tippin and Matt Rizzo with the driving simulator. You fall asleep behind the wheel of a 40-ton rig, and 4.2 people will go to the grave with you. I mean, you'll kill somebody, fall asleep driving a car. So that's a potential danger. Now, that's one of the negative concomitants of relatively little sleep that – there's something restorative about sleep, and as such, you may be sleepy when you're trying to function during the day.
Claire, do you feel like your partner suffers from this lack of sleep?
Oh, yes. I mean, he's not been able to hold down a job. He is in bed for about 10 or more hours a day, just trying to get that half hour. He's very sensitive to the environment. So it's definitely been a lifelong problem, and we have not found a way to solve it. So I was wondering if you had any other advice, I guess.
Well, you know, as I always say, be real careful when some doctor or anybody gets on the radio and tells you within 15 seconds how to solve a lifelong problem. You know, one of the things is the primary care, the general practitioner, the family medicine doc is the backbone of medicine in the United States. And they're all part and parcel of our sleep training programs. In fact, we have a sleep fellowship that if you're in family medicine, general or internal medicine, you can sit for our fellowship. And as such, most people with sleep problems are primarily seen by the general practitioner. First thing I would do is talk to, and if he doesn't have one, he needs one. And it's well worth the investment. As I've already implied, I've got my general practitioner. I don't take care of myself, and I see them at least once a year because I'm only human. I'm at risk for all the things that you're at risk, and I have had insomnia, but mine was related to sleep apnea. There are over 95 specific differential diagnostic categories in our international classification of sleep disorders that can screw up somebody's sleep, as you've briefly described. And as such, I'd start with your general practitioner. And once the general practitioner does the history and physical, which is the basic premise of medicine, if they think they need the expertise of a specialty clinic, there's a lot of specialty clinics in Iowa. Hopefully, we've trained a lot of those doctors and nurses, and including our clinic, where they can sit down, take a long history, and see if there's one of the specific 95 differential diagnostic categories. If that diagnosis is made, then the therapy will be very specific. Not necessarily easy, but very specific. And as such, that's what I do now. It sounds like this is a major problem for this person.
Yeah.
The other problem, and the statistics show that people who tend to sleep much less than 7 to 9 hours of sleep and who tend to sleep much more than 7 to 9 hours of sleep, as I've already implied, they're at risk for a lot of morbidity, like falling asleep behind the wheel of the car, and as such, mortality. You don't do well if you're going 75 miles per hour into a brick abutment. So, in a nutshell, go see your primary doc. Talk to them. If he doesn't have one, should get one. It's well worth the investment, and we would be happy to see him in the sleep clinic. But again, a lot of our students, they're all over the state. We have a very highly educated group of physicians in Iowa in the Midwest area. I then see the experts, the specialists, if you need to.
Claire, thank you so much for your call, and good luck. I hope that's helpful, at least a place to start for you and your partner. We have Sharon on the line next. Hello, Sharon.
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
My husband has a CPAP machine, and do you ever talk about the partner who has to sleep with them when the air blows on us that's very cold? We were told not to do anything with it.
Well, you know, and that's why And a lot of docs right now, they haven't been able to – it's a branch of medicine in its infancy. And it took us years to get my technician, that's Mr. McKinney, and this is all he does. He sees people with these kind of complaints, and he'll talk about positioning at night, the size of the bed, how you lay on your side, heated humidity, different machines, different masks. Is the mask working? Is there a leak involved? The machines are often becoming quieter. Do you have an old machine? Is it giving unnecessary noise off? But these are important issues. My thought is, if you have a bed partner, in many societies, it's the family bed. You got a lot of people who may be affected by this machine. Now, the machine, as we've said, it just makes common sense. Low oxygen is a bad thing. It's a necessity, and it's a simple, relatively, therapy, but it involves the rest of the family, the bed partner. And in that regard, be real careful with a lot of us doctors with long white coats. We know a lot about the physiology. We know a lot about the anatomy and statistics, but you really need an expert who knows about the CPAP machines. There may be over 200 different interfaces. That means fancy term for mask and machine combinations. And if you see somebody who knows the ins and outs and the kinds of problems you've briefly described, that's the best thing. And that's what I would recommend. Go to a CPAP clinic, and there are more and more of them around the state right now for you to be seen. In fact, we have a CPAP clinic. But talk to the technician who knows about the mask and the machine and these issues. The doctor means well, but no one has enough gray tissue in their brain to know everything. And again, as the years go by, the technicians that are expert in this regard will become more and more plentiful. But again, branch of medicine in its infancy.
All right, Sharon, good luck with that. And next up, we've got Kevin on the line from Ames. The number to call is 866-780-9100. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Sorry, I just turned off the radio.
Oh, good.
So I have two questions, Dr. Kane. One is, is there any place for a nasal pharyngeal airway in the management of obstructive sleep apnea? Hello?
Well, all right. And put that in English for us, Dr. Daikin.
Well, you know, as I think this is implicit, I had a recent surgery, and there are different devices that can actually go through the glottis, which is the vocal cords that we use when we get tracheostomized, you know, when you get intubated during a surgery. But I didn't want my vocal cords to be all messed up, and I asked for a nasal pharyngeal, sort of a dilator that would open up the throat without having to pass the glottis or the vocal cords to do damage. But there are these nasal pharyngeal masks that we actually use when people have under anesthesia surgeries. My thought is, though, and what is implied, you know, is that that might be pretty uncomfortable. We have oral pharyngeal devices. We do a lot of different monitoring where we can actually stick tubes down the nose into the stomach to monitor abnormal paradoxical respirations that we often see and respiratory effort related events with apneas. But, you know, a thing just strapped on the outside of your face rather than going down your throat, you think that's uncomfortable. Now, we do have a variety of oral devices, and the ones that have been most successful and most comfortable, as apart from the continuous positive airway pressure therapy, are devices that you put on your teeth that pull your jaw forward and open up the airway space. We call it the anterior airway space. And in some people with mild to moderate apnea, that is an alternative to CPAP therapy. Doesn't get rid of all the apneas, but it's something you place in your mouth, and over a period of time, a dentist, orthodontic surgeon, a lot of people who deal with this machine specifically, they'll slowly advance your jaw forward. You might be at some risk for temporal mandibular problems, etc., but they're able to define whether they're opening up the throat, and if you clinically improve, they'll repeat a sleep study to see if you're now safe and you have a acceptable level of apnea or a complete cure. But as it's implied, every time you stick something over the face or in the mouth, And we even have tongue-retaining devices. Think that might not be uncomfortable. But right now, the nasal pharyngeal devices, and I know we use them often in operation. I actually had that during a surgery. But I think it's a comfort issue, and as such, routinely it's not used. In the future, who knows?
Well, it seems like it would be very difficult to put a mask on yourself if you were actually inserting a tube into your nasal passageways.
Well, and that's the thought. I mean, there are, and as is implied, there's a million ways to skin a cat, which I would never do. But my thought is, God bless America. There are people who are making money because they're coming up with very comfortable devices that are making people happy and keeping them healthy. The number one danger with a known sleep apnea is poor CPAP compliance because the mask is too uncomfortable. And as such, these are not far-fetched ideas. A good mask, a good oral device, a jaw-retaining device, a tongue-retaining device, a nasal pharyngeal. I mean, whatever works, and if you can make it comfortable. But again, at the present time, that's not something we're routinely utilizing with continuous positive airway pressure.
You mentioned an oral device, and you do see advertisements for these. They look like mouth guards, pretty much. They look like the kind of thing you'd wear playing football, used to treat sleep apnea. How effective are those?
Well, in people with mild to moderate apnea, they're a reasonable alternative. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine has certain recommendations for their use. And under the guidance of an expert, and there's a lot of people in the state who are utilizing those and they have their preferences. Depending on the study you're reading, there is marked improvement in some cases. Again, it's a selected population, not the severe apneics generally, of a reduction in apnea hypopnea index. Usually not a complete cure. You usually don't get the number of apneas down to zero. But we know if you can get it well under 20, that you often reduce the risk for hypertension and stroke.
Okay. We have a couple people who have a similar question about genetic sleep apnea. Is this something that there's a genetic link?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are millions of people with sleep apnea. Normal people can have sleep apnea. And there can be transient sleep apnea because you gain a whole bunch of weight, blah, 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 so forth. And, is it genetic that I have 2 feet? Well, my parents both had 2 feet. I have 2 feet. Yeah, it must be a genetic phenomena. And oftentimes, the shape of the throat, the central nervous system that might lend itself to apnea, a variety of apneas. Now, we've talked primarily about obstructive apnea where the airway closes, but there are different kinds of apneas that you might be inheriting. But in some regard, I sort of got the jaw my daddy had. I sort of got the weight my mama had. And you make that combination, I'll bet you money they got apnea. But every time I tell my parents about that, they pat me on the head and they're glad I'm using my education. But I think in some regards, yeah, there's probably a genetic component, but it's just so common. It's such a common phenomena. It's like having 2 feet. Yeah, having 2 feet is a genetic phenomena too in many of us.
All right. Ray is on the line in Mason City. And I know, Ray, that was part of your question. Do you have another question for the doctor?
Well, when I went to Canada a few years ago with friends, they were telling me how much I snored. When I come home, I put a tape recorder under my pillow and I didn't snore. Now, my sister does have sleep apnea, but I sleep well, 8 to 9 hours, 9.5 hours a night, and I wake up feeling fine. And I know that's supposed to be one of the signs.
Yeah, if you're feeling fine, don't go see any doctor for your sleep apnea. My general rule of thumb, if you feel good and it ain't broke, don't try to fix it. One of the things, I don't know if that was Sharon, who was talking about her bed partner's CPAP machine, sort of bothered her. Now, snoring is a different issue. It can be associated with sleep apnea, but if your apnea is really bad and your airway closes, you don't snore or stink. But snoring, boy, if you can't keep your bed partner in the same room because the severity of the snoring is so bad, well, that is a different issue. And there are otolaryngologists who can remove that tissue to improve the snoring. That's usually the treatment of choice. But third-party payers think it's cosmetic, and I think there are a lot of negative elements of just loud snoring. But if you don't have any problems and you sleep well at night without any insomnia, that means difficulty sleeping, and you wake up refreshed, and your bed partner and your family members really are doing just fine, stay away from me. Because I'm sure to say, well, let's do a sleep study. And if you have very, very mild apnea, I may say, well, I'm a carpenter. I'm going to treat it. You know, I'll build you a little wooden birdhouse or put CPAP on your head. And my general rule of thumb, if it's not bothering you, don't go hunting for more problems. Nevertheless, see your general practitioner once a year. Make sure your prostate is checked and your colon is okay and your blood pressure is doing well. That'll keep you alive longer than just doing $3,000 to $4,000 studies and putting CPAP on your head if you're not feeling bad.
All right, Ray, thanks so much for your call. And we're going to go to a break here in just a minute. Dan in Webster City says he's gained 20 pounds since going on a CPAP machine about 6 months ago, and he wants to know if that's normal.
Well, you know, you can see anything, and God bless America. I have seen some people who feel so good after being on their CPAP, they do what the rest of us do. You know, you feel better, you go out to more movies. I always put the butter on the popcorn, all this. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to envision why somebody who might feel better might gain more weight. Now, there is a phenomena of undertreated sleep apnea. If the pressure is not high enough and you're still having insomnia and still sleepiness of what we call leptin insufficiency, where the normal chemical in adipose tissue that is supposed to keep you satiated and increase your metabolic rate to burn up extra fat tissue or adipose tissue isn't working. So it's always a possibility if you don't feel good that the pressure's not high enough. But if you really feel good, what do I do when I feel good? Christmas, I eat.
All right. Thanks so much for your question, Dan. We're talking about sleep disorders today. We've been talking a lot about sleep apnea, but we'll take your sleep questions on any subject. Dr. Eric Dykin is a professor of neurology and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. You're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Dr. Eric Dykin. He's a professor of neurology and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We've been talking about sleep disorders today and sleep apnea in particular, but if you have sleep problems, feel free to give us a call and join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have an email from Linda in Hiawatha, and this is a long email, so I'm going to summarize, but she has sleep apnea. She's tried a CPAP machine that didn't work for her. She used a BiPAP machine, and I don't know what that is. What is a BiPAP machine?
It's just a little bit more comfortable. It's got a mechanism where it senses when you inspire, and the research to date has shown by Dr. Sullivan and Dr. Sanders at Pittsburgh that you need a higher pressure to keep the airways open on inspiration. So you're going
with
the
flow.
When
you breathe in.
And when you breathe out, you can usually get by on a lower pressure. And the BiPAP machine senses that. So when you're breathing in, you're going with the flow. It's easier, higher pressure. And when you breathe out, it senses it and gives you lower pressure just to keep the airways open. And as such, you're not breathing out against a small hurricane. And it is usually subjectively more comfortable, but a lot more expensive.
All right. So anyway, she had the BiPAP machine and it was not working for her. She ended up just not using it. And she says she's getting about 5 to 5.5 hours of sleep a night, although she sometimes needs to take a nap in the afternoon or evening. She exercises regularly, monitors her blood pressure, and she's concerned about the fact that she's not using this treatment, if she's doing any damage to herself by not using the treatment.
Well, you know, and I had read the note too, Linda, so it was, a lot of good questions. But she'd also been told by another doctor that she had relatively mild to maybe insignificant apnea. And it's all, again, a branch of medicine's infancy. According to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, if you stop breathing 15 times per minute, let's say you just had a sleep study for fun, but you had no insomnia, you had no daytime sleepiness, you just did this sleep study, and you stopped breathing just a little under 15 times per minute, you had no heart disease, high blood pressure, or stroke, or any problems like that with your health, then you don't have significant apnea. If you have any complaints of sleepiness, insomnia, or heart disease, stroke, or hypertension, then that same number becomes significant, that you might be prone to vascular disease. Now, the true studies to date generally look at your risk for high blood pressure and stroke if you have an apnea-hypopnea index, the number of times you stop breathing per hour, of 20 or more. So someone said you had mild apnea, and some people often consider that less than 15. So right now, the way you presented it, you really didn't have any major complaints. Look at your blood pressure, and the question is, are you really significant sleep apnea according to standards? Well, you know, again, I don't have the whole history, but somehow you came to a doctor and had some kind of report that wound you up in a sleep laboratory. So we want to be careful about that. So you've got the number of times you stop breathing and then the degree of oxygen desaturation. But if it's very, very mild, I do believe in some cases there are normal apneas. And we know that when we go to sleep, we decrease our respiratory effort. And when we go to different stages of sleep, it is normal to have a cessation or a central apnea. And if there's no oxygen desaturation, that one doesn't even count. So it may be that one of your doctors reviewed your study, for example, let me speculate, and said you had a very low number, like 6 or 7. Your oxygen saturation hardly dropped at all, and you feel really, really good. And the doctor said, you know, and as you've implied, if you sleep on your back, you're a little bit worse. Why don't you do what Dr. Dykin does, do positional therapy? Now, she's really a lady who uses the tennis ball and finds them uncomfortable. And she says, you know, and I do feel better with positional. What I would do is Google that. Look for positional therapy for sleep apnea. Get one of the more comfortable things. Get rid of that tennis ball doogie thing that you did at home. These are really pretty comfortable. Wear that, and if you feel really good and you don't have any health-related problems and you have no sleep-related, do that until you do have problems. Then go back to the doctor. But remember, talk to the doctors who really looked at your studies. You know, I'm not privy to that. And ask all those questions, because I think there are some people who really don't need anything more than positional therapy. But again, I'm not privy to that. I went from an apnea-hypopnea index of 17 events per hour to zero by weight loss and positional therapy, and that did a lot for me. Talk to your doctor about these specific issues, and if it's still a question, come over to my clinic. We'll talk to you. Bring all your data.
All right. Next up, we've got Jacqueline on the line from Des Moines. Hello.
Hi. I have sleep disorder. I wake probably hourly, but my main problem is I have severe restless leg syndrome, and I'm not allowed to take L-dopamine because I'm a truck driver. What other options do I have?
Well, you know, the dopaminergics are, and that's what L-dopamine, dopamine and the cinnamic combination of levodopa, carbidopa is the cheap, you know, very affordable medication. And I don't know why you wouldn't be allowed to take Sinemet, but the problem with Sinemet, and this is why there are new dopaminergic agents that are more specific. There's all these neurotransmitters and chemicals in your bodies. Well, there's a lot of different receptor sites. The newer medicines that are like dopamine plus that are very specific for restless legs, in my anecdote, really seem to be a lot better. They're a lot more effective with less side effect. They're a little more expensive, though, because they're new medicines, and they tend not to have what we call there's a period where actually the medication may cause the symptoms to progress a little bit more rapidly, and that's what they've seen with the simple Sinemet L-DOPA dosage. The new medicines might have less of a tendency to do this, and we call that term augmentation. It's like the tail of the dog that bit you, that the medicine, although it decreases the symptoms for a while, it may increase the progression of the restless leg severity. The newer drugs are not supposed to have those problems. Now, what you may be alluding to is the fact that some of the side effects of the newer dopaminergics include sudden falling asleep at the wheel, that some people paradoxically will be driving along and then, boom, fall asleep. And there's a second major problem where people often become a little bit more uninhibited. And it has been reported that people will go to Las Vegas, spend all their money, and have affairs with strangers. I mean, that's really been reported. Those are the two big scary things that people are reporting that might keep a truck driver from not driving off or falling asleep behind the wheel. I'm just speculating. That's why the doctors don't want you on it. But Those medicines were not only used in people with restless leg syndrome, but they were also used in much, much higher doses in patients with Parkinson's. Parkinson's disease is usually a progressive disease that frequently involves a relative level of dementia where you may do things you otherwise wouldn't when you were a younger person, and you may have very poor sleep-wake cycling because it affects the sleep-wake centers in the brain, and you can fall asleep within a moment's notice during the day. That's a phenomena, my belief, when I review the data, that may be an epiphenomena of the Parkinson's population. That hasn't been discerned yet. And as such, when people that you're working for hear that you're on the medicine said, well, I can't afford the litigation. What if you fell asleep behind the wheel? Well, if you don't have any evidence of Parkinson's, and people with restless legs, again, generally do not develop Parkinson's. I have restless legs when I fly. So it's not an unusual for people over 50. I'd talk to your boss again. I'd be happy to talk to your boss. And if they review your overall history and physical exam, and you give us permission, I think you probably could still be a candidate for that medication, knowing that, yes, those are potential side effects, but it sounds like you don't have Parkinson's disease, and I think you're relatively low risk. But again, it's a litigious society. I can't promise you wouldn't have sudden onset of sleep behind the wheel.
Okay, so you're telling Jacqueline he should go back to the doctor and
See if you can get on the newer dopaminergics, because they're supposed to have less side effect, supposed to be more efficacious, less chance of the augmentation, big long word. And in your case, if you don't have signs and symptoms of Parkinson's and you're using a lower dose, it might be relatively worth that relatively what I think would be a low risk for you.
All right. Mark's on the line next from Cherokee. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, what's your question?
Just wondering if you had any experience with altitude-induced sleep apnea. A little background, I do backpacking, and last time out experienced sleep apnea at extreme level and actually had to come down. But I am extremely fit, not overweight.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting phenomenon. And I think this is what you're implying. When we travel in altitude, some of us, you know, we need oxygen to keep alive. It's in the air. And our waste product is CO2. When we go to sleep, we generally decrease our respiratory effort, and the CO2 comes up, and it sort of keeps us breathing. So when we go in altitude, all that pressures and the CO2 and the O2, all that stuff changes a little bit, and our sensitivity to CO2 and O2 changes. And there is a tendency for some people to develop more of a central sleep apnea at altitude, which again, I know people have talked about carbonic anhydrase inhibitors be taken, you know, so many weeks or days prior to traveling at altitude, maybe accommodating over a period of time. But that does become problematic. You know, there's a lot of issues with traveling and being at higher altitudes other than just this central sleep apnea that might be induced. But as you say, there are certain medications that might be tried, but it is a bit of a genetic tendency. And until you're really up there at altitude, you may not know that you have this problem. And again, it may be something that just your friends, et cetera, notice, because how do you really tell if somebody's having apnea when they're sleeping? Because we often, you know, but my thought is the signs and symptoms, and I think, you know, if you can feel it. And I'd have to take a look at the books, but there might be a pre-hiking utilization of carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, but I'd have to check that out again. That might be something to see a sleep specialist for.
All right, Mark, does that help you out a little bit?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, sir. And next up, we've got Ross on the line in Davenport. Hello, Ross.
Hi, thanks. Hey, Doc, what's the could you comment on the effect of the CPAP or BiPAP machines on the Eustachian tube and the sinuses?
Well, you know, it's really it's just the weirdest thing in the world. This continuous positive airway pressure, it is a pressure. So in some regard, it's a very gentle pressure, but it is pounding on the back of your throat. in your nose. It's having an effect on all the head. And it does induce just a little bit of trauma, a little bit of swelling. And in some people, you know, they'll say, oh, my goodness gracious, you know, it's pounding on my nose, and my headache is worse, blah, blah, blah. But it's really a weird, interesting phenomenon. With the newer machines, the heated humidity use, I have people say, oh, the doc, this is not going to work. I got nasal congestion. My nose is full of snot. I got allergies. And swear to God, and my chief technician who deals with that, Don McKinney, says, well, I think it's because there's a filter. But a lot of these people often breathe better, you know, so whatever works. But, you know, sometimes nasal drops, sometimes your allergy medicines, and sometimes, and I, you know, it's just a rhyme or reason. I know of a few people who say it makes everything worse. But as the years have gone by with the better machines, an awful lot of people say, actually, it clears up my nose. But, you know, if it creates a pounding headache, which is always a potential problem, and if it's only during the time that you're having your sinusitis, et cetera, and you're on your antibiotics, sometimes temporary use of positional therapy, sleeping with head of bed elevated and recovering, depending on your severity of apnea, would be an alternative. But it's amazing how well people have done in this regard with CPAP.
Okay. I appreciate it, Doc.
No problems.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Ross. And we've got a question on email from Ken. And I know this is a subject that's close to your heart, Dr. Daikin, because we were treated to an impromptu concert here in the studio before the show. By the way, if you go to our Facebook page, you can see a picture from that concert. And Ken wants to know, he says, is there any indication that vocal cords can be affected by the use of a CPAP machine? I'm a veteran. I have used a CPAP machine for several years, and I can't imagine living without it. But I also notice problems with my vocal cords. Could there be a connection between the two?
Would that be cool to check? Yeah, we just had this. We were talking about, I didn't want to have, when I had my surgery, I didn't want formal intubation going through the glottis, which is the hole in the back of your throat that comes down to your lungs through the trachea where your vocal cords are, because they do some damage to that. I mean, it pounds on there. And the thought is you got this continuous pressure, essentially keeping the airways above the vocal cords from flopping closed. And that's an interesting question. That might vary with humidity, the time of the year, whether you're using heated humidity as a supplement, supplemental oxygen. And, you know, between you and me, I can see potentially for a group of high-level singers where it could help or hurt. Nat King Cole. Who was that other fella? But they would smoke, you know, and Nat King Cole passed because of that. But it caused enough inflammation and edema to his cords that he got a rich sound. And I've heard singers say, I can't stop smoking. I've got to keep that baritone deep bass sound. And I don't think that's a smart reason to keep smoking. But I almost wonder if that pressure head has any effect that might suffice and supplement and replace the need for smoking. So this is me, you know, I tend to look at things, you know, as the half full glass instead of half empty. And I'm wondering if I ought to go back to the machine and see if I can get a deeper, richer tone. But I have never really heard that it's affected the singer's voice. I do know that the old surgery we used to use routinely, the uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, can change the sound of what you produce. And you can have to learn to, you know, drink through a straw so it doesn't come out your nose because the uvula is gone, the thing that flops down the back of your throat. And I think rather than surgery, as a singer, I would prefer the CPAP and see if it makes me sing like Nat King Cole, who's like a hero. But I don't know. Wouldn't that be a cool study to do with the School of Music? Yeah. Well, thanks for the idea. Right. If we publish this data and I get it funded, maybe we'll get you as part of the group. But I don't think it's unnecessary.
Thank you to Ken.
Yeah, thank you, Ken.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your email and for all your questions today. Dr. Daikin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. A lot of fun.
Dr. Eric Daikin is a professor of neurology and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese, our executive producer and musician here in the studio. You can see him on Facebook is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Brian Dow. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And of course, you can send us email anytime with your questions, your comments, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day, and it's time to start planning for this spring's garden. We're going to talk about garden design tomorrow. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.